You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. At the beginning of March, we held a virtual Food Matters Live event. We brought together the best minds across geopolitics to geoeconomics, new technologies to new nutrition solutions and supply chains. Experts from across the globe discussed innovations to future-proof our global food system. One session that I found particularly fascinating was about food security in the US. A staggering 50 million Americans will experience food insecurity, including 17 million children, as the country reels from the damage of COVID-19. It's a level of hunger not seen in the nation since the Great Depression. The session was chaired by Michael Roberts, the executive director of the UCLA Center for Food Law and Policy.
I think sometimes we take for granted the way we think about food. A major breakthrough, for example, in connecting agriculture and nutrition was made, for example, back in the days of when the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization was being organized, when President Roosevelt and others saw this connection between food or agriculture production and nutrition. And ever since then, these connections have become more and more apparent. And now we include, of course, the environment and human rights and other sorts of values that we connect to food production. And so the complexities continue in an advanced industrialized nation, as is the United States. These issues sometimes are compounded by technology and by other complexities.
Michael asked the panelists what they thought the main barrier was to achieving food security in the US. First up, Danielle Nierenberg, the president and founder of Food Tank.
A huge barrier that we have, you know, that we can't unsee is the massive inequality and inherent racism. I think we've at this point heard over and over again how the pandemic has exposed cracks in our food and agriculture systems in the United States. Everything from long supply chain disruptions, especially at the beginning of the pandemic, to the deplorable conditions at meat processing plants that have exacerbated the spread of the virus for many folks. And we've seen the massive inequality, lack of access to healthy, affordable foods, and the inherent racism in our food and agriculture systems. And so I think one of our biggest challenges is really realizing that agriculture needed to be revolutionized pre-pandemic, and that post-pandemic, it would be a huge mistake if we returned to the way things were. The unprecedented challenges we face provide a lot of enormous opportunities to create a food system that can't be broken, one that is truly regenerative and restorative, and that leaves no one behind. And to, you know, sort of build on Michael's point earlier, realizing the complexity and the interconnections are, I think, more apparent than ever. And more people, whether it's eaters or businesses or government, are really realizing that we need to break down the silos once and for all that have really existed in our food and agriculture systems and start making those connections.
Dr. Sally Rocky, the executive director of Foundation for Food and Agriculture, agreed with Danielle and said that we also needed more data.
Yeah, I would agree with Danielle, but I would also agree on the technical front that having real-time information and real-time data is so critical. And this was amplified during COVID, where we did not have real-time data, and it exacerbated the problem. So I think that if we can build systems that have that opportunity to get real-time data, we'll be further along.
Also on the panel was Travis Smith, Associate Professor in the Department of Agriculture and Applied Economics at the University of Georgia.
Yeah, I really think that I would like to see the federal government here in the United States couple these programs again with issues of access and information. We have these programs set up to give out benefits, but we don't have much in terms of implementing usability, such as just simple budgeting and planning and how to think about utilizing these benefits more efficiently that we already have out there.
Caitlin Welsh, Director of Global Food Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, highlighted the different levels of food insecurity along racial lines.
One thing that we've seen consistently is that there are higher levels of food insecurity among Black and Latino households than among white households. So for the latest tranche of data that we have from the Census Bureau shows, for example, that white households with children experienced food insecurity. 10% of those households, sorry, about 9% of those households were food insecure. For Latino households, about 17%. And for Black households, over 19% of households with children experienced food insecurity. So again, we're seeing consistently unequal rates of food insecurity among households in the United States, consistently high though. The trend pre-COVID was that food insecurity was falling, but I'm predicting that when we see official data come out of USDA this year, that we'll break a number of records, unfortunately. And the reasons for that, the two main reasons that I see that I'd like to talk a little bit more about today, one, of course, is income. And I'll borrow from a professor at Hunter College in New York who says that food insecurity is fundamentally an income problem and not a food problem. And as we're seeing during the pandemic, the economy is the single most important factor in determining food insecurity among Americans. I am hopeful that the American Rescue Plan will ultimately help alleviate food insecurity, not only through the food security specific provisions, but through all of its other provisions that help to supplement income. So happy to talk about that. And then I also think it's food insecurity in our country. It's not just a problem of income. It's also a food problem. And we'll borrow from a recent book by expert Robert Parlberg just to talk briefly about food swamps, where he says that the real problem hasn't been a lack of access to healthy foods, but increased exposure to unhealthy foods, that low-income Americans are in trouble, not because they're in food deserts, but because they're drowning in food swamps. There was a study a few years ago that food swamps were a stronger predictor of obesity than food deserts. So I think we have a combination of a problem of income, insufficient income, and also the types of food that are most readily available.
Anne Byrne is finishing her PhD at the Dyson School of Applied Economics and Management at Cornell University.
I think one of the lenses that I want to bring to this conversation is, you know, we have a large number of people who are food insecure or hungry, who are not availing themselves of the services that exist. So, you know, in 2018, there were over 50,000 food pantries across the United States, and only 29% of food insecure households were using food pantries. So, you know, even though there were food pantries that existed in their communities, these individuals were not necessarily using them. And I think we have to ask ourselves why. Why would a person who's hungry or food insecure not choose to use such a service, not choose to use a food pantry, and not choose to use SNAP, our food stamps program?
It almost seems like the pandemic has offered us a glimpse into perhaps more slower pandemics of inequality or inefficiencies or so on and so forth. Is that what we're seeing, or has COVID shown us something we didn't already know? Sally?
Yeah, I would say you're exactly right. I mean, it really amplified all the vulnerabilities in the system all at once. So it was a very dramatic situation. I think also it amplified the touch point, I mean, the complexity as we know it, and also it created this butterfly effect, right, where something happened at the beginning of the food chain and it went all the way down to access and availability of food in poor and economically vulnerable populations. So that butterfly effect was something that we had not, I don't think, prepared for.
Another question I have for all of you, we've talked about the effects, and some of you have mentioned groups that have been singled out or inequalities due to food insecurity. And I would think, too, I would ask you to even look beyond COVID-19, the pandemic, the after effects, especially with migration perhaps being an issue. But who are the groups that are most susceptible to food insecurity in the United States? And what are the unique equity challenges that prevent us from helping these groups? I'm going to go in reverse order this time, if you don't mind, kind of mix things up. Sorry to catch off guard, Travis, but you're on.
No, that's great. I mean, one thing that I was thinking about in terms of also what Sally was mentioning is these exposures, in the butterfly effect of the SNAP inadequacy of SNAP benefits. So if we think of groups of individuals beyond race and ethnicity, but also in terms of the intersection of food costs, for example, You know, in the United States, the benefits are practically the same for everybody. So we have inequities, even in terms of like urban, rural, where we have not only costs of the actual food, but there's the cost of that, of, you know, accessing food also. And so I think that, you know, because of the pandemic and the amount of people that are actually getting exposed to the food assistance safety net, and then reading about it, they're really seeing, oh, wow, this, you know, for example, the SNAP benefit formula, which is based off of, you know, 70-year-old data, maybe we should revise that. And I'll let others hit on some other issues.
Caitlin.
Thanks. What the data are showing us is that families with children are consistently more food insecure than families without children, that women are consistently more food insecure than men. As I had mentioned, minority populations are consistently more food insecure than white families. There are some policies on the table that I think, again, would go a long way addressing this. One in particular is the a monthly checks to for families with children that's being that looks like it's about to pass in the American Rescue Plan, which I think will ultimately go a long way improving food insecurity for families with children.
Anne?
My work has largely focused on private assistance and a lot of work on food banks and food pantries. And so I spend a lot of time in food pantries. And one of the things that is always very notable is the number of people who have health ailments and who are living with chronic illness, who are living with addiction, who are living with obesity and mobility problems. It's astounding. And I think, you know, the lack of health care that is provided for many of the people who are also food insecure is a major problem. And I think that's a group, you know, it's a large group, but that is a particular group that I think we should focus on.
Thank you, Sally.
So I would agree with everyone on it's quite apparent which are the groups most effective. And again, it was amplified by COVID. But one group that I think students in general without going to school any longer, this became a really intensely problematic area of how they were going to provide food for those students that were getting it through the schools. One thing I do want to just add on is I had an interesting discussion prior to COVID about food insecurity on college campuses. And it's really surprising that between 15 and 25% of college students at some point in their college career are food insecure. And we didn't really think about that when COVID hit and students now were at home, and that changed for them as well. So it's students across the board and the whole infrastructure of schools and colleges providing.
Danielle.
I can't add much more. I think the points about women being more food insecure than men is such an important one, and one that we don't talk enough about. I want to go back to something Caitlin said earlier about, I think it was Caitlin, the idea of food swamps and sort of the how poor communities or underserved communities are inundated with all of these unhealthy food choices. A term that, you know, I think sort of fits that idea better is this idea of food apartheid, which I learned from Karen Washington of Rise and Root Farm in the Bronx in New York, because it's part of the systemic racism that I think keeps so many people food insecure in this country, where, you know, it's a concerted sort of effort to leave certain communities out of the food system in so many ways. They don't have grocery stores. They don't have, you know, corner stores with healthy options. They certainly don't have farmers markets. So this idea of food apartheid, I think, is really an important one when we're talking about who doesn't have access or can afford, you know, food in the United States right now during the pandemic.
Excellent, panelists. Thank you very, very much. Let's now shift gears to looking at solutions. We've identified the problem. We've looked at the barriers. I think we've comprehended that this is a complicated issue. And now let's start thinking about solutions. So what's an innovative tool that you've come across that either at the local level, the university level, it can involve technology or research or access, or even at the private level, that could alleviate the pressure on the food system and promote food security? I'm going to mix it up a little bit even more, and we're going to go to you, Caitlin, first this time, and then kind of work our way around in whichever order I feel like going.
Thank you. I've got a few answers to that question, but one in particular is the expansion of the ability to use SNAP and WIC benefits online. Right now, 47 states are in pilot phases, and there's one more state that's approved. So almost all 50 states are allowing people who benefit from SNAP and WIC to use them at certain online retailers. So I think that that's excellent. I think that you see the innovation of general citizens throughout the pandemic. For example, there was a group of college students starting at Stanford and Georgetown, but it's a number of other universities now, who are helping to link farms that were unable to sell their produce to food banks. It's called the Farm Link Project, which is, I think, an excellent example. And then a really local example is in Washington, D.C. I live in this region. A number of restaurants are supporting community refrigerators where they're simply providing healthy foods for free at community centers. There's no limit in how many you can take and who can take them. I do not think that that's a long-term solution, but I think that it's just an example of innovation and how we can step in to address the challenge in the short term.
All right, thank you. Anne?
Sure. So, you know, in the food bank space, there's been some really great advances in terms of mobile food pantries and putting food pantries on a truck and bringing them to rural communities and being able to serve people that way. I think there's also been a shift that's been really important in trying to co-locate food pantries in locations that people already visit. So putting them on college campuses, putting them in medical clinics, you know, trying to destigmatize and provide this food in a location where people will be able to access it without having to, you know, make an extra trip to a building that says food pantry and stand outside of the food pantry building. And I think, you know, those kinds of efforts to really recognize that just because you put some food out on a table doesn't mean that somebody's necessarily going to want to take it, even if they're hungry. Food is a very personal thing. It's a very important and personal thing. And people have preferences and they have a sense of pride around their ability to acquire food. And, you know, trying to be able to meet them where they're at, I think is really important. And then the other one I'll mention is this. I know this exists in Boston. I imagine it exists elsewhere. But Daily Table is a store started up in Boston by the founder of Trader Joe's, and it's essentially a nonprofit grocery store. And so what they're doing is they're collecting grant money and, you know, doing fundraising as a nonprofit in order to provide food that competes on price with fast food, but is much healthier. So it's prepared meals and they're offered at a lower cost. So it's meant to meet the needs of lower income families in the neighborhoods that they serve in Boston.
Interesting, thank you. Travis.
Yeah, so I definitely want to echo what Caitlin said about SNAP and being able to use it online. That was, you know, something that was coming up, but then it was just underutilized and all of a sudden everyone was using it. But another one, again, I'll just move down the food assistance programs in the United States, is for school food. So a lot of people were unaware of the summer feeding program that we have in the United States. The way this works essentially is the federal government will partner with communities, you know, it could be like a YMCA or a local church. And this is to provide meals during the summertime when kids aren't in school. And so what the USDA did during the pandemic was to open up the funds from this program to allow communities to serve food when schools were out. And they're still utilizing that. Like I'm here in Gwinnett County, a suburb of Atlanta. And so when they had to just pivot to remote learning, you know, then you could start utilizing the summer feeding program. Now, the problem, though, is again, I was mentioning earlier, is the logistics of this. And there's been a lot of learning. And even from last fall to this spring, I know here in Gwinnett, they've gotten much better at getting the information out to the parents. But I think that's something that's innovative, that it's really like a learning by doing. It's unfortunate that it wasn't set up to be able to work so great at the beginning of the pandemic. We're getting better at it. But I think moving forward, more people will know about this program, especially during the summertime and when schools are not in session, so that we can get more food to the kids through the school feeding program, but just when they're not in school, because that, you know, that's quite a few days of the year.
Danielle?
I think we have to recognize how much farmers during this time have had to pivot and learn skills that they didn't have before. Farmers who are selling directly to restaurants, didn't have to do things online. They didn't have to, sort of reach out to consumers. They were selling in bulk. They didn't have to package things differently. So I've, talked to, hundreds of farmers over the last year who've really made extraordinary strides in pivoting to online marketing, to doing, some of the mobile markets that were already discussed, to delivering straight to people's homes through CSA or subscription boxes of food. So those are all really, I think, innovative things. And farmers aren't getting a lot of credit for that. And they're obviously going to need a lot more support to continue doing that, because this, even when the pandemic ends, I think people will be reluctant to, go back into grocery stores and do some of the things that they were, doing before. So I think farmers need a lot of support for that. I also want to push back, while Wholesome Wave and online SNAP benefits have been, I think, an extraordinary accomplishment. And it was said that now 47 states are, folks can use their SNAP benefits online. That's extraordinary. But I do want to point out that there is some pushback on that. Folks like Davita Davison of the Detroit Food Lab thinks that's more of a band-aid than a really the revolution that, we need to have a food system that works for everyone, where there is access to healthy, affordable foods and people can access those in their own communities and not really rely on an online system that sort of perpetuates, in her viewpoint, a lot of the inequity that continues in the food system. So just, while I personally think that's, a great accomplishment, there are communities who, think that more needs to be done.
Sally, you get to pick up the rear this time.
One thing that emerged is what Danielle had talked about, is that in the past, many of our cities and regions were just in time buying, right? We had, for years and years, we had figured out what is needed in grocery stores, what is needed in food banks, all of this. And we've gone from just in time, which led to a major problem during COVID, to have to think about long-term planning. And the local farmers have become so essential in this, and that interconnection between access to locally grown foods was amplified during this look at the food system under a crisis situation. So it goes back to all these big tech questions about data and having access to data, and also being able to model the systems. We need so much more information in order to be able to model the systems to prepare for what's going to happen in the future. We have to be really much better at predicting what's going to happen. We've been through the experience now through COVID, but we have to be better prepared for the next.
It strikes me that it's interesting, we talk about how complex these problems are and the barriers, and many of the examples you've listed on innovation are very specific and very sort of lane focused. And I think that's good. I think it tells us that there are a lot of different things that we can do to attack these problems. And yet, as Danielle reminds us, it's important to, to be able to measure. And the other underlying theme I think that's come across very, very strong in this panel so far is the need for information and data. I'm going to ask you now to broaden your focus just a bit. We've really focused a lot on public health and nutrition, but as in the classes that I teach at UCLA, we try to expand our horizon a little bit by looking at these connections between food policy and the health of the planet and the health of consumers. What kind of are there connections between the planet and the health of consumers that you're seeing emerge in your work or your discussions around your community? Let's go to Sally. We'll start with you first this time.
Okay. Well, of course, a big focus of our foundation, as well as most of the USDA and others, is that interconnection between environment and agriculture. We think about the environmental impact of agriculture. We know, for example, with greenhouse gases, that agriculture contributes to greenhouse gases. But we also are the only sector. First of all, we're the most impacted by environmental change of any sector. Secondly, we are probably the only sector that can naturally mitigate some of these problems. I mean, this is really what's so important about agriculture, to be a centerpiece and a focal point of mitigating climate change. Climate change has such an impact not only on communities across the world, but on agriculture production itself. And we when we're thinking about transforming agriculture to be not just a yield-based production system, but a nutritional quality-based production system, it also has to be an environmental resilient production system. All of those things are interconnected. So this connection between producing healthy food, the environmental impact of that production, and then what the environment and climate change can do to agriculture is so intertwined. So we must, again, study all of this in together, because when we see a change in environment, the access to food and healthy food, oftentimes, for example, let's say just the rising temperatures move pests and pathogens farther north that could cause production problems when you have to deal with them. The nutritional quality of food can change depending on the production management system, the soils, the temperature, et cetera. So all of this has to be studied in depth to understand all those interactions.
All right. I want to ask you one last question, and I'm going to frame it in a way that you'll have to be very succinct. So you have an invitation to go to the White House. You have President Biden's ear for about 30 seconds, and this is a shock to you, but he's invited you to come whisper over by the Oval Desk. There's a lot of people milling about, but he wants to hear your view on what would you say about food security? What's his priority? What does he do? What would be your top priority? What do you tell him? Caitlin.
I would tell him, number one, that he's right to have emphasized the role of income in food insecurity in our country. So kudos for that. Clearly, he's been working on this issue for decades. And number two, I would encourage him to create an independent office to coordinate efforts among all departments and agencies that influence food security in our country. I think it's improving food security is not something that any one department or agency is equipped to handle. So I think we need a coordination body at the White House.
Perfect. And maybe he'll hire you. Travis, you got 30 seconds for the president.
I would like to see the Women, Infants, and Children program broadened. Allow kids to stay on until they get into school. Don't cut them off at 5, right? And then also broaden the package and allow more foods. You know, white rice is okay, I believe, and that's what I would like to see, to really focus on food insecurity and also thinking about nutrition at the same time.
Danielle?
I've thought about this deeply. I have 4 points. I will say them in less than 30 seconds. Better support for new and young farmers, including student loan forgiveness and extension services that will really help them to increase food security in their communities. Fulfill the promises to BIPOC farmers that were made generations ago, including access to land and reparations. Expanding union rights to all farm workers and food workers, including collective bargaining and legal protection under the National Labor Relations Act, and supporting regenerative agriculture and making it possible for conventional farmers to transition if they wish to do so, as a key to solving the climate crisis.
Perfect. Thank you. Anne?
I would, you know, expand the eligibility for SNAP and increase the average amount that SNAP benefits, you know, of SNAP benefits. And then I would also say work with county governments to implement programs to expand SNAP enrollment. SNAP is an economic multiplier. Counties will get more bang for their buck. You know, they get more money out of the SNAP dollars that come into their county than it costs the federal government. So working with those local municipalities to expand SNAP in their areas.
Sally, the last 30 seconds.
Yes, I would have 3 points. First of all, I would have a White House conference on agriculture and nutrition that hasn't happened since the 1970s, so we need to have that. Secondly, I would name Tom Vilsack, the Secretary of Agriculture, as Chief Nutrition Officer. And thirdly, I would change the name of the U.S. Department of Agriculture to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forest.
Wow, these are radical, great, very important changes. We should send this to the White House, I would be my recommendation. Since we are addressing food security in the U.S., there's nothing more American than to turn to politics. We do live in an age of polarization. We all know that. That's something that we don't have to convince anyone of. It's very evident. Can we depoliticize food in order to meet our food security goals? Are these political issues, or are these issues that rise above politics? And if so, how can we contribute to that in reaching a more secure system in the U.S.? Danielle, would you please go first?
Sure. I don't necessarily think we should depoliticize food. I think, you know, as Wendell Berry said, eating is an agricultural act, but it is also a political act. And the idea of a citizen eater, which has been proposed by Bob Martin at the Center for a Livable Future here in Baltimore, where I live, I think it is a good one. The idea of an informed consumer who she votes based on her values around the food and agriculture system. She chooses things at the grocery store or at the farmer's market based on her values about the food system. These are things that I think are inherently political. So I think what we do need more of is bringing civility back to these conversations and bringing civility back to how we talk about agriculture and how we talk about the food that we eat.
That's great, Danielle. You reframed my question, which I really like, but your point is to give the consumers actually more political heft and let them take a more prominent role in decisions. Caitlin?
Yes, I do think it's incredibly important to depolarize discussions around food in our country. When it comes to support for global food security, there's consistently bipartisan support in Congress for this. There was a time when support, for example, for SNAP and WIC programs did enjoy, when that support was bipartisan. That's certainly not the time that we're living in right now. I hope that we can make progress. And, you know, I don't know if it's going to take focus groups or communication campaigns or what, but I want to get to the point where it's not a discussion about do we not support domestic food security programs, but rather what's the best way to do it.
Very nice. Thank you. Travis.
I agree that we should depolarize rather than depoliticize. And, you know, I teach a food policy class that I focus on this, and I spend a lot of time with my students at the beginning of the semester trying to depolarize these discussions so that we can actually talk about the programs without it being so political. And I think what Caitlin said is great, because what I usually see is that most people, once they're informed, they're on board with all these programs. It really comes down to the little bitty pieces. How do we tweak it? And I think if we can move there, then that's great, because then we can focus on making these programs better than really just thinking about, you know, getting rid of them or really making them polarized.
It's almost inviting consumers and others to think with us in terms of food systems thinking, which is actually kind of interesting and challenging at the same time. Sally?
Yeah, I would say that one thing that we've enjoyed over the years is that in the Senate, in particular, the ag committees are very bipartisan. I mean, this has been an incredibly important aspect that we see support on both sides of the aisle. So I'm pleased with that traditionally in Congress has been agriculture in general has been a bipartisan issue, although obviously politics can come in. But I love the concept that all of our previous speakers have said about depolarizing instead of depoliticizing, and I would agree with that.
And Anne, I saved you for last for a particular reason. I have been impressed that in many ways this next generation is going to think about these issues differently than us older folks. And I'm heartened by that. And in terms of depolarization or looking at food systems issues differently, speak to the youth, if you would, please.
Yeah, I mean, so I'll give you an anecdote, because this is one that always stands out in my mind. I was working in a homeless shelter where we were providing meal services. And a gentleman came in, he was homeless, and he came in for a meal, and, you know, they said, okay, you're going to have to, you have to do a chore to help out to sort of cover the meal. And he was fine with that. And then one of the volunteers did something that made him feel undignified. And he said, you know what, I don't need the meal, I'm going to go. And it stuck with me because he was willing to give up food, which we need, and which he clearly needed and had come in expressing need for. He was willing to give it up for his own dignity. And I think that is an important lesson when we think about food assistance programs, is that people, you know, food is a matter of dignity. It's a matter of identity. And if we want people to use programs and we want them to use assistance, we really need to ensure that it's not a shameful act to do so. And I think that depolarizing is an important step in that direction, to make sure that these are programs that people are willing to use and feel okay and feel dignified using.
Perfect answer, Anne. I knew you'd come through for us. Thank you food is dignity. And I think that that's that resonates very strongly with all of us. Thank you so much. You've been a great panel. You get great answers to sometimes awkward questions and articulate questions. So I appreciate you bailing me out. And you've been wonderful. So I think our time is up. And just want to say thanks again to all of you.
Michael Roberts ending that discussion from a Food Matters Live event. You also heard from Danielle Nierenberg, Dr. Sally Rocky, Anne Byrne, and Travis A. Smith. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from microbiomes to international supply chains. Follow us to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Thanks for listening.